This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. President Donald Trump has celebrated the capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. There are a number of aspects to discuss, and we've asked our regular political contributor, Professor Paul Fabrizio from McMurray University, to talk through the story with us, specifically with an eye on West Texas and that perspective. Once again, thank you for joining us on the West Texas Dispatch.
It's good to be here. Thank you very much, George.
Let's start with some historical context. How does this military action compare to other previous military actions?
Well, you have to be honest. When you look at the United States and Central and South America, the United States has a history of intervening in that part of the world. You go back to the Monroe Doctrine, as President Trump brought up. It said that the United States is the dominant group, dominant country in this hemisphere. And so we have that right. So the United States has exercised that right. It's not found in law. I have to be careful. It's a right that we take upon ourselves. We've exercised that right many, many times in a variety of countries, from Mexico to Panama to Haiti to the Dominican Republic and now Venezuela.
Grenada.
Yeah. You go back to the 1970s, Chile. Mm. So the United States has always been an active presence. We have done things there militarily. So in one sense, this is not new. And we have to start from that perspective.
That is a good perspective to have.
This is not new.
He isn't calling this a military action, though. At the moment, at least, it's being called a law enforcement action. Democrats saying that's not the case. But they're calling this a move without approval. Is this type of action something that should be or is typically run by Congress?
It should be run by Congress, but it's typically not run by Congress. Congress did not approve the Panama invasion to capture Noriega. Congress did not approve the action in Grenada. Congress did not approve the action in Chile in the 1970s. I mean, Congress has passed the War Powers Act that says that they can be involved. But the simple reality is that administration after administration, regardless of the party, has said, hey, here's an opportunity to act quickly. It takes too long to deal with Congress. Let's just go ahead and do what we want to do. And so the Trump administration is simply following a precedent that's been set by many other presidents in the past.
Putting politics aside on this one, and I know that's hard to do for a political science professor.
No, it's easy, actually.
One of the most interesting, shocking things about this story, as we've all been following it pretty much nonstop since it happened, is the visuals of this president, Maduro, being taken out so quickly out of his country. And he was arraigned yesterday or this yes. week in New York. That is amazing how fast that has happened. And I think that has taken the breath away for many people just to see it happen that fast.
Yeah. And what that tells you is that the administration has done some serious planning. The military did the job that they were assigned to do, apparently spectacularly. I mean, imagine going into another country that is filled with missiles, anti-aircraft missiles, and all that sort of stuff from Russia, and we defeated them without much of a problem, apparently. And we got in there, got this guy, the president of the country, and got him out with no loss of American life. That's absolutely amazing to think about from that perspective. Yeah. I mean, our military has done something that, I mean, I think rightly should be recognized. The legality of it is a whole nother question, but the actual operation of it was pretty amazing.
It is. I think another aspect of this story that maybe isn't talked about enough is what it's done on the stage as far as the hemisphere goes. Because, you know, immediately since you've heard talk about, well, Colombia has crossed a line and we need to take a look at Mexico and maybe Cuba needs to be in line. There's been, I guess, threats or some sort of statement made by this action saying, we're the big dogs here, right?
Exactly. And I mean, in one sense, this isn't a surprise because that's what President Trump has been saying. He said it in his first term, but I don't think people believed him. He's demonstrated it in his second term. And what it speaks to on a much larger basis is that this president really believes in this concept of spheres of influence, where the United States has a sphere of influence, and that's the Western Hemisphere. What that implies is that we're not that interested in other countries' spheres of influence, like China, like Russia.
Yeah, I think the reaction to the Ukraine,
yeah,
it kind of proves that point. That's interesting. Here are a couple reactions, Dr. Fabrizio, that we've gotten. Senator John Cornyn, of course, of Texas, released a statement. He said that the Venezuelan regime has posed an acute threat to the national security of the United States for decades. He went on to call Maduro a corrupt dictator, and he ended his statement by saying that he applauds Trump's leadership and that he was praying for a quick recovery of Americans who were injured there. Again, you mentioned nobody died. Congressman Arrington, of course, said the congressman from this district, congratulating President Trump and those on the ground for a, quote, well-executed operation. He said he and the people of West Texas are, quote, grateful for a commander-in-chief who is committed to making America safe and respected again. Is there anything surprising about either of those statements? Is this what you would have expected from Cruz and Arrington?
I think this is what you'd expect. This is what you have to say if you're a Republican politician. You have to support them. What they're not talking about is what comes next.
Yeah.
And they didn't say anything about what President Trump said, which is that we run the country now. And that has not been authorized by Congress. There's been no money that's been given for that. How is that going to take place? The details of that have not been announced. And as a consequence, these two gentlemen have been largely quiet on that subject.
It's interesting that the easy part seems to have been the military action.
Right.
But as we learned from Iraq and Afghanistan and Vietnam, and my goodness, the list goes on and on, taking care of a nation is just unbelievably difficult.
Exactly. And President Trump campaigned against nation building.
Mm.
And yet, what is he talking about doing right now? And that's building up Venezuela again. He's trying to get the oil companies to be more involved. He said he's willing to send American troops back to Venezuela. And so, you know, what is the plan? All that stuff still has to be worked out.
The America First, I think, was kind of one of the big talking points of President mm-hmm. Trump's reelection campaign was, you know, we are about America first. That's what's going to be most important. Do you think his supporters are going to be more supportive of the fact that this is in that hemisphere of influence that you talked about? This isn't Iraq. This isn't on the other side of the world. This is somewhat closer. Is there going to be more patience for nation building?
I don't think there's going to be any patience for nation building because that's not where President Trump supporters are. But at the same time, I think they're going to support him right now. Now, if we talk again about this thing in 3 months after there's been violence in that country, well, we might be having a much different kind of conversation. Right now, I think people are just so focused on the present. There's some people who are bringing up the future, but the reality is I think for most of President Trump's supporters, it's like, let's just focus right now on what we've done. We got rid of a bad guy. Totally ignoring the fact that that bad guy's assistant is now the new president. That bad guy's government is still in place.
Right.
But we got rid of the bad guy. That's what we're going to celebrate.
So in other words, this story is going to unfold.
It's going to unfold, and we don't know where it's going to unfold or how it's going to unfold. And it's possible in the unfolding, this could become a bigger national security crisis for us. And we just don't know. Or it could just fade away.
There's one other, I think, giant piece to this puzzle, and that is the biggest oil reserve in the world is located under the ground in Venezuela. We have a lot of oil companies in America. How big is oil playing a part in what happened in Venezuela? Do we know?
Based on President Trump's statements, oil is playing a big part.
Yes.
But based on the behavior of the oil companies, it's not as big a deal. Other than Chevron, the other oil companies aren't involved. They're not rushing to get back there. Remember, the price of oil is about $60 a barrel, West Texas Intermediate. So it's not really that high. They really can't afford to go and do extensive renovations, the billions of dollars that are required in Venezuela. So we don't need that oil right now. the market prices are low enough that we don't need enough. In fact, you can argue there's a glut of oil right now. So while President Trump is talking about oil, I don't see the oil companies talking about their desire to go back to Venezuela.
Well, speaking of this Venezuelan, I wouldn't call it crisis, but I would if you were in Venezuela.
Right.
What else are we missing? What else is important about this that we need to think about?
Just what actually you brought up, that we don't know what's next. Mm. We don't know the long-term plan. We don't know if there is a long-term plan, and we know that in the past, without the thinking about that long plan and the planning for it, we can get in trouble. And you brought up Iraq, and that's a prime example of where good intentions can go bad. And so President Trump trying to get rid of Maduro, good intentions, good execution of getting rid of him.
Right.
But what happens now? We own that country. What happens? How are they going to respond? We don't know.
All right. Lots to think about with this, and a lot more will be coming out. Paul Fabrizio, thank you once again for coming in and offering your wisdom today.
Thank you, George.
Paul Fabrizio is professor of political science at McMurray University. Stay tuned to KACU for all the perspectives on this story in the coming weeks and possibly months. This is the West Texas Dispatch. A recent CDC-published map of the United States shows Texas as one of the states with very high flu activity. That map, based on the week of December 27th, a week with a lot of travel across the country, showed a high presence of influenza in the United States. Texas Health and Human Services reporting shows that week recorded a 10% increase over the week before. And the flu is just one of those illnesses circulating. We have asked James Tunnell, he is a registered nurse with Hendricks Infection Prevention Department, to give us a local picture on the cold and flu season. Thank you for coming in and taking a bit of a break from the ER to head our way.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. Well, we've been hearing about the super flu. The CDC data shows that it is its primary flu is flu A. That's what's showing up in testing. Tell us, what is Hendrick seeing, and what is the super flu?
So Hendrick itself, in this local area, we're seeing flu A predominantly, but flu B is also neck and neck with it.
Wow.
And that's very typical for this area. We don't see anyone leading the charge just yet. And again, very typical for this time of year. Right after the holidays, we start seeing flu A come up a little bit more. As the kids go back to school, everybody gets back home from traveling, we start seeing the flu A kind of come up. The super flu that we're talking about is it's a strain of flu. It has a little bit more serious symptoms, mm-hmm. But it is still just the flu. The treatment is all the same. It's just a little bit more aggressive symptoms.
So tell us about what you're seeing in the hospital right now. As far as patients go, people that are coming through, what kind of symptoms are they showing, and how serious is it?
So we are seeing those admitted with respiratory symptoms, so difficulty breathing, and usually it's those elderly patients who already have other issues going on, asthma, COPD, things like that, that kind of make things worse. So they come in with already having difficulty breathing, they get tested for flu as a cause, and then they have flu A, typically is what we're seeing right now, being admitted in the hospital.
The CDC has reported more than 120,000 hospitalizations. Has Hendrick had a lot of patients? You know, you've been there a while, comparatively year for year. Is this a lot?
It's not, to be honest with you.
Interesting.
In our area, we're not being hit that hard right now. Typically, we see our high numbers at the end of January, early February. And so we're still in our low area.
So
right
we're
now.
Not in peak flu season as far as Abilene is concerned.
For Abilene, correct.
Every flu is different. What are the symptoms? What should we be paying attention to as normal citizens out there?
So if you have a fever, so anything over 100.4, I would really recommend staying home. If you're school-age children, if you have a fever, if you have to take Tylenol to reduce a fever, that doesn't count. You still have a fever. So I stay home to prevent the spread. Make sure you wash your hands. Other symptoms you may feel, those body aches, the chills, sweaty. You may feel a little sweaty. Difficulty breathing doesn't always manifest itself in healthy individuals right away. So it's always other symptoms, something that you just don't quite feel right. So,
well, that's good advice on, you know, keeping your coworkers or maybe the people that you go to school from catching what you have. But I have to ask this question. I've always wondered this. As a parent, I got a sick kid or a sick wife who really wants to come to bed with me that night. I mean, what should I do as far as what can I do to keep myself fever free if it's in the house?
I call it the friendship pillow. Put it in the middle between you two.
Oh, I like that. I like kidding. That.
No, you know, a lot of family members, they're in such close proximity to each other already. Their immune systems are going to be very similar to each other. If one gets it, it's unlikely you're going to prevent the spread within a household, unfortunately. But wash your hands. Good cough etiquette, good sneezing etiquette, cough into your elbow. Clean frequently touched surfaces. So a lot of people don't realize, but the doorknob into your house is probably the most touched thing that you can not ever clean, the outside of your doorknob. Clean that, clean doorknobs to your restrooms, things like that. That'll definitely help the spread.
Very interesting. I do not think about the front door, but that is a very good point. Yeah. Well, we're in the middle of flu season. It takes a little time for that vaccine to be fully effective. And one of the first questions of the only question actually I asked you before we came on the air is it too late to get a flu vaccine right now?
It's not too late to get the flu vaccine. You can get it pretty much any time during the flu season. Now is just as good as time as early October to get it or early September to get it. So if you haven't gotten it already and you want to get it, go ahead and please do get one.
And just for clarification, of course it protects you, it protects others, but it also can help with symptoms, can it? Can it make them a little less bad?
Absolutely. So if you already have some sort of immunity to what we suspect would be the most dominant flu strain, if you already have some sort of immunity, then of course you're going to be protected no matter what strain you get hit with. So the severity of the symptoms will be less.
What about kids? They're back at school. Kids don't always maybe pay as much attention to all of the health concerns that parents have. What can they do? What can you do to send those kids out the door to keep them as safe as possible?
So again, if they're running a temperature, I would strongly advise keeping them home to prevent that spread. Even if you have to give them, you know, fever-reducing medications, I would still keep them home. Outside of that, teaching them to wash their hands for a full 20 seconds, that's the key. 20 seconds of vigorous hand scrubbing. Start teaching them that early. They'll be more likely to wash their hands more often throughout the day. Also, cough etiquette, not coughing in people's face, not coughing in close proximity to other people, coughing in their elbow or in their shirt would be very beneficial to a skill they can start developing at any age, really.
We've been hearing about changes in recommendations for all kinds of childhood vaccines. In fact, we heard this week there have been some pretty major changes as far as what's being asked for by the federal government. Is there anything patients need to know locally about getting that flu vaccine, or should they go get it for their kids?
So the CDC does recommend, and I actually think it's required by law, that everybody gets information about the vaccine that they are being given. So if you're not getting that, please ask for information about the vaccine. That way you know what to expect after you get it and what to expect. Even if you have questions, if you're on the fence about it, that education will help you make that educated guess or the educated decision to get that vaccine.
And a quick follow-up on that. If I want the vaccine for my kid, or if my kid wants the vaccine, what's the availability like, and will insurance cover it?
So as far as I know, there's been no changes from previous years. You can definitely contact your child's pediatrician for any of that information. And then however it's been paid for in the past will likely remain the same.
We mentioned the flu isn't the only virus. COVID is still out there, by the way. RSV, stomach bugs. There's a lot of things sending folks to the ER. What are you guys seeing out there?
So right now we don't see too much. We actually keep track of all of our COVID, flu, and RSV numbers all throughout the year. And we don't see – right now we're in the flu season, of course, so we have a little bit more flu numbers. But we don't really see too much one way or the other right now to have a dominant strain of anything. We do see RSV typically creep up in children this time of year. And I did see that same map you were talking about earlier. I did see that Texas has a high RSV level as well. But again, we're not really seeing that right now in this area.
Well, not quite as important, but still miserable for many of us. There's so many maladies out there right now with similar symptoms, and one of them has got to be allergy. Cedar fever out there is horrible right now. What can we do to reduce the misery, I guess?
Yeah, cedar fever is one of those things that you just, even if you don't have allergies, you may experience symptoms related to cedar fever. And so things you can do is just that good cough etiquette.
Yeah.
Wash your hands. Make sure some of the symptoms for the Cedar fever could cause like a sore throat, irritation, things like that. They can very, very much mimic the flu. However, you just gotta, you know, the flu really has, the fever is kind of like the biggest thing. So Cedar fever doesn't really have a fever associated with it. So just good cough etiquette, wash your hands, clean highly frequently touched surfaces, and that should help spread the.
So it sounds to me like if you're confused about what you might have, because there are similar symptoms out there, wait for that fever to pop up.
That's the biggest tell, is that fever. But if you really just don't feel good in general, then you can always make that decision to get tested if you would like for the flu, because a negative flu test will tell you if you got flu or not.
Maybe if we ever got some winter in here, that would help with the Cedar fever too. I know you're not a weatherman, but we could probably use some cold days.
I got a weather rock outside of my back porch, so.
James, you're a solver of all kinds of problems. I love that. Thank you so much for joining us. James Tunnell is a registered nurse with Hendricks Infection Prevention Department. We thank you for all you do. Get lots of rest, take your vitamin B, and get yourself through the next couple of months.
I appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
We keep you updated on cold and flu season as it continues. Stay tuned to KACU. This is the West Texas Dispatch. The world's supply of many life-saving medications depends on people in the United States deciding to sell their blood plasma. Without them, there would be a global shortage of critical medications and a public health crisis. But what does it take to be a supplier of this indispensable resource? In part three of the series, Blood Work, TPR's David Martin Davies shows us what it's like to be a compensated plasma donor.
Bright fluorescent lights, rows of plastic chairs, and a line of people waiting. The lobby of a blood plasma center is a cross between a medical clinic and a fast food restaurant, and I'm on the menu. On this day, I'm here to sell my plasma. The plasma center is full of willing, compensated donors. Many are clutching blankets, water bottles, and earphones, items that will make the process more comfortable. It's clear, for them, this is a familiar routine. But before you can donate for the first time, you have to pass an extensive health screening. Plasma is turned into treatments for people with serious conditions, like immune and bleeding disorders. If a donor has certain infections or health issues, those can be passed on through plasma products. So centers use questionnaires, vitals, and lab tests to catch things like HIV and hepatitis.
Okay, and I need your digital ID, please.
After I speak to the receptionist, I verify that I have a social security number and a permanent address. I'm told to watch a video that explains the process.
Plasmapheresis is the automated procedure that separates the plasma from the blood cells.
Then I'm sent to a nurse, and the questions dig deeper about my health, travel history, medications, surgery, tattoos, have I had sex for money, or had sex with someone who has had sex for money, have I ever had hepatitis, have I ever injected drugs, have I been in jail. It's intimate and deeply impersonal at the same time, and I pass. And then it's off to the main donor room. There are 8 rows of 10 reclining lounge-like seats. It's almost completely occupied. People have tubes running from their outstretched arms into whirling plasmapheresis machines. Many are stretched back with blankets. Most shake their legs occasionally while they scroll on their phones or listen to music. The phlebotomist, the workers who collect the plasma, wear white lab coats and talk with the donors. Many are regulars and they know them by name. One older donor calls the phlebotomist over and hands her his headphones. He wants her to hear the music he's jamming to. It's the 80s band Simply Red, and the song is Money Too Tight to Mention. Next, I get hooked up. The needle is thick, but it goes in smoothly. Not painful, but a dull feeling of ache and pressure. The clear tubing fills with dark red blood, pumping into a machine at my side. The centrifuge spins my blood, separating the plasma, the yellow fluid, and sends the red blood cells back into my body. I'm told to squeeze my fist every few seconds to keep the blood flowing, but if I want a rubber ball to squeeze, that would cost $1. An hour later, the machine beeps, and I'm done. I'm unhooked, A purple bandage is wrapped around my arm. I'm thanked and sent on my way. The debit card they gave me is now loaded, $100, for being a first-time donor. I'm David Martin Davies in San Antonio.
A lot of Texans use their time off over the holidays to get outdoors. The holiday season is one of the busiest times of year in the Big Bend region of West Texas, with its cool desert temperatures and wide open state and national parks. There's currently a new spread of public land being developed in the remote Chinati Mountains south of Marfa, and while it's not set to formally open until 2032, park officials are working on ways to let people in sooner. Marfa Public Radio's Mary Cantrell recently got a sneak peek of the new state natural area, 39,000 acres of pristine Chihuahuan desert landscape that also has a rich human history.
A UTV engine starts up on a cloudy day in South Presidio County. At the wheel is Cody Edwards. He's superintendent of the nearby Big Bend Ranch State Park, but he's also overseeing the development of the new Chinati Mountain State Natural Area.
I try not to go anywhere into the backcountry without a jack, a tire plug kit, a small compressor to air up tires, and my trusty traction boards.
The landscape is filled with fleeing jackrabbits, towering yuccas, and rugged mountains, remnants of a supervolcano that erupted here millions of years ago. Texas is in the midst of a public land boom made possible by a $1 billion state endowment created a couple of years ago. But this swath of Chinati Mountain rangeland has been in state hands since the 90s. Lack of a public access road has delayed its debut, until now. Edwards says, like other state natural areas, Chinati will remain pretty primitive.
We're really trying to minimize extensive development in order to, you know, provide that wilderness, that raw outdoor experience.
In 2026, select local outfitters will be allowed to bring small groups into the park, meaning some lucky hikers will have the chance to access the Chinatis before the 2032 opening date. Features that set this new state natural area apart from other nearby parks are an abundance of springs, in particular a rare salt marsh cienega or spring-fed wetland. There are also stone cabins that will be refurbished for public use. While the park doesn't encompass Chinati Peak, it will still be billed as a premier hiking destination with 50 to 100 miles of trails. Jose Alonso Muniz grew up on this land. His family ran cattle near the Chinati Mountains for nearly 40 years. Muniz now manages a herd of longhorns at nearby Big Bend Ranch State Park. He says he's glad his old stomping grounds are becoming a public park.
It's very green in summertime, and all you gotta do is just watch out for rattlesnakes.
Muniz recalls riding the fence on horseback and getting caught in storms during the summer monsoons, when heavy afternoon rains often led to flooded arroyos in dangerous conditions.
I would get my dad under some brush and cover him up with some saddle blankets and saddles, and hail would hit us, lightning, and just get out of there as safe as we could.
Park officials say there's evidence of human occupation in the Chinatis dating back several thousand years, so one of their major goals will be to locate valuable archaeological sites and ensure their preservation before tourists start streaming in. Local archaeologist and historian David Keller will be a part of that effort. He says he's expecting to find plenty of evidence of prehistoric people, where they camped, prepared meals, and made tools. But a lot of that history just hasn't been studied here before.
You could almost say safely the Chinatis are largely unknown to science. And so there are botanists. I have a botanist friend who's got a permit. He's aching to get in there because there's so little known. It's terra incognita. So it is very exciting.
You could see Sierra Barda, and then you have the San Antonio Canyon.
Local resident Arian Velasquez Ornelas flips through maps of the new state natural area. She works for the State Parks and Wildlife Department as a park interpreter, and she hopes archaeological digs will result in new information about the area's indigenous populations. Her own husband, a Presidio local with Lipan Apache heritage, is a lineal descendant of human remains uncovered by Chinati Peak, dating back to the year 1275.
This is still continuously the same people, you know, generations upon generations afterwards. And so to me, that's a very important part of my job, is being able to provide that history that connects us to the resources, to this pristine land.
Back at the park, Edwards, the superintendent, drives the UTV up to a lookout with spectacular views, three canyons all converging with Chinati Peak in the distance. Edwards proposed to his wife on a mountain peak in nearby Big Bend National Park and named his daughter Elena after Santa Elena Canyon. He says this planning phase of the new state natural area is a defining moment.
I want to do right by this place, and that's what my staff wants to, and that's why we're here. And that's the driving force, you know, for me.
He says at the forefront of his mind is the delicate balance ahead between increasing accessibility and protecting this precious piece of borderland backcountry. I'm Mary Cantrell in Marfa.
It's time for West Texas Roots. This week we meet Sarah Cater, one of the owners of Free Play Arcade in downtown Abilene, to hear how a seventh-generation Texan came to find the Abilene community home, from enlisting in the U.S. Air Force to bringing ageless retro fun to the downtown scene. Sarah isn't just living in the Key City. She's part of the vibrancy.
I actually was joining the Air Force and had gone, and we were packed up my life. I had a quick ship, and I went out to basic training within 2 weeks. It was quick. And due to paperwork issues, I got removed almost through basic training. And I spent 12 weeks there fighting my case. It didn't work out. Came back home, no plan. I had quit Free Play, who I'd been working with forever, to go do this. And hey, let me go see what's happening. Let me go defend my country.
Right.
And then it just all landed just down my face, you know. And then the next day I called the owners, Kelsey and Corey of Free Play. I was like, hey, what's going on? They're like, can you please come back to us? And do you want to ship out and move to Abilene? I was like, you know what? I'm not doing anything right now. I have no plans, no future. Let's do it. And that's how it happened. I knew about Abilene because I had a brother that went to Hardin-Simmons, and then I have a cousin who met his wife at ACU. They were in ACU. So I've had family that have been here but aren't from here and then left and went back. So it's weird because I was very I'm not going to Abilene. I was very much very in the DFW, and now that I'm here, I will never go back to the DFW. I have all the siblings that have left. They're talking about moving here to Abilene too now that we're here. So the original 300 people that settled with Stephen F. Austin, that is my family line. And when I die, apparently it's going to be on my tombstone if I choose so. So I probably will. I think it's kind of cool. Tejas means friend. That was the whole point, is everyone was friendly. And that's how it was when I was a kid. I could walk to the candy store that used to be in my downtown when I was a little girl. Everyone was looking out for one another, not better behaved, because, you know, someone says mama could see me and they know my mama's number and they're going to call. And it takes a village to raise, and we've lost a lot of that. And some of that's technology. Some of that's just this great California rush coming here. There's a lot that's changing within our state, and it's kind of breaking down the heart of what Texas originally was, I believe, personally. It's hard to watch. It was a sense of community, and Abilene has a lot more of that than I've experienced in a very, very long time. So I love it. I love it. Because my kids, I know there's parents across the way that will be like, your kids are ding-dong ditching. That's been the new thing they discovered. And I was like, they'll do that, kids. I'm proud of you. We definitely saw growth coming to Abilene and this downtown. I'm so glad they're redoing it. As frustrating as it freaking was and took way too long, I will never say otherwise. The downtown's going to be nice. And I love the community downtown. It's the best in Abilene. This location is the only one that actually never goes 21 and up. We go 18 and up only. We did originally do 21 and up, but there's so many college kids here and we want y'all to all experience it. So that's what's great about video games. It's for any age. Truly, anybody can play those games and have so much fun. These kids can go in there and play Mario Kart. Not my favorite game. You'll rarely see me play it, but I will go play Journey for hours, or pinball. Oh my God, I'll be on pinball forever. You've got some fun stuff for adults, but then you want your family at the Paramount watching. We're gonna go see. Now you have more to do downtown. Coffee, games and fun and parties, art, food, see a movie. There's stuff to do in downtown now. So it's people need to be here. As much as people complain about the north side, like, I love it because there's character in the houses. Like, my house was built in 1938. I love it. I'm in love with my house, and I love the character and the history and the past it has. And I love the neighborhood because none of the houses look the same. That's what they have. That's what I love about all these buildings. Mm-hmm. Like, they took a lot of it, but they kept some good parts left. Oh, Christmas was so gorgeous downtown this year, especially since they finished this construction. And next year, hopefully, we can have the parade back right down here. I think it'll be amazing.
We recorded Sarah Cater's story in historic downtown Abilene. This is the West Texas Dispatch. The Abilene Philharmonic welcomes 2026 and its third Masterworks concert of this season. This week on Conductor's Notes, Greg Strawn speaks with Maestro David Itkin, music director and conductor of the Abilene Philharmonic, about that upcoming show.
David, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, the music on this concert comes from the heart of the orchestral repertoire from the very end of the 19th century. In fact, both pieces were written in the same decade, the 1890s. You're starting out the concert with Amy Beach's Piano Concerto, and I'm confident the orchestra has never played this work before. And I don't think very many of our audience has ever heard music by Amy Beach on a live concert. Tell us a little bit about this romantic piano concerto and who will be performing.
Well, I think a lot about how to talk about this piece.
Sure.
And I finally distilled it into one sentence. I was thinking about it on my way over here. And what it is if Chopin and Grieg and Rachmaninoff all got together and jeans spliced, they'd be Amy Beach. Because,
fantastic.
Which is not to suggest that Amy Beach is not an original composer of her own right, but the influences of these people are very strong.
Yeah.
You will hear these moments of sparkling little sort of Norwegian moments that you feel the Grieg. There's the delicacy and virtuosity of Chopin in the piano writing, and then there's this bombast and gigantic gorgeous tunes of Rachmaninoff, get them all in one piano concerto, and it's really quite charming. And you get all of that, and it's a piece you've never heard, which is really quite exciting.
That's fantastic. Tell us a little bit about who's going to be performing the concerto.
Yes, our soloist is Asia Korepanova, and we've never worked together. Here in Abilene will be our first time meeting, let alone working together. We've corresponded, we've talked on the phone, and I came across Asia because she is one of the probably dozen people per month who sends me an email, ice cold, says, here's who I am. Would you please think about hiring me to play in Abilene?
Sure.
And I get a lot of those, and they all go into a file. That's a nice word for where they go.
Sure.
But, you know, she was particularly talking about the Amy Beach Concerto, which is one of her specialties. Which not a lot of people do, and it's a piece I was thinking about trying to program here.
Great.
So that one went into a special, smaller file, shall we say. But then, by coincidence, a wonderful pianist I've worked with many times, who's been here, but it's been some years, Anthony Patton, turns out to be a close colleague of Asia's. And we happened to be talking, and I don't know how we made this connection, but I said, you know, do you know this? I think maybe they had a festival in common. Maybe I asked. And he said, oh, yes, she's fantastic.
Oh, great.
You got to think seriously about this because she's a wonderful person and she's a wonderful player, and you're going to love doing the Beach Concerto with her. So that took it to a whole new level, and here she is.
Well, that'll be fantastic. What a great opportunity for our audience. David, thanks so much for being here and giving us your conductor's notes. David Itkin will conduct the Abilene Philharmonic in their first concert of the new year, Saturday, January 17th at 7:30 p.m. at the Abilene Civic Center. You can find out more information about this performance and how to get tickets on our website, kacu.org. I'm Greg Strawn, and you're listening to Conductor's Notes with the Abilene Philharmonic on KAC. And
we leave you with some thoughts from our friend Glenn Dromgoole.
Would you rather be rich or famous? Or both? Or neither? As one who is neither, let me offer a couple of thoughts on the question. Yes, I have to say, I would like to be rich. Yes, sometimes I think I would like to be famous. Then I look at the news and see all these people who are both rich and famous, and I wonder, is that how I'd want to live? Could my wife and I go out for, say, a chicken fried steak or a hamburger without drawing a crowd of people who want to take a selfie with us or have me sign an autograph? If I had more money than I could possibly spend, would I appreciate it and do something worthwhile with it, or just blow through it on trivialities and unwise investments? And then I start counting not what I don't have, but what I do have. A loving wife, good friends, a standing in the community, a nice home, a little money in the bank, and it strikes me, I'm as rich and famous as I want or need to be. How about you? This is Glenn Dromgoole for the West Texas Dispatch.
Glenn is the writer of some 36 books and runs the Texas Star Trading Company with his wife, Carol. This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon. Plan to join us and tell a friend and subscribe to the podcast. The West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also find it on the KACU mobile app and online. We had help this week from our executive producer, Heather Claiborne, producer Joe Herrick, and our digital editor, Calvin Claiborne. Special thanks to JC Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.